Hey, my friends, this is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. My mission is to help people get in touch with their emotions and feelings and to be a source of healing. Usually, my job on this show is to interview the world-class experts in different domains, but this episode is an experiment and a quick recap of two episodes published in February of 2022. I took about the first 15 minutes of each episode and combined them into the single episode. So if you enjoy the short version of each guest interview, you can listen to the guest's full interview. And before we start, please know that every Friday, I share a newsletter which has all the latest podcast updates. And I also include 3 to 5 new things I'm currently learning. They can be any book. I'm exploring new blogs and articles I'm reading and resources from YouTube and anything else that captures my attention during that week. And you can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me, and nishantgarg.me. And now let's begin. Today's guest is Dr. Gail Brenner. Dr. Gail is a psychologist, author, speaker, and lover of truth with a fire that burns brightly. She is an expert in healing from early trauma and brings years of experience with individuals and groups. Her work lovingly illuminates our everyday humanness with the deepest spiritual truths, and she is known for creating the space, safe space, needed for inner exploration. Gail has special expertise working with older adults and their families in the transitions of aging, death, and dying. She was an assistant clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where she trained physicians and maintained a clinical practice. She has published numerous professional articles on coping with stress and chronic medical illness and is the author of the award-winning The End of Self-Help and Suffering is Optional. She loves healthy living and exploring different cultures through international volunteering. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very happy to be here, and I appreciate that you invited me.
I'm so happy to be here as well. When I was reading about your work is about discovering peace, happiness, dealing through trauma healing, and working on the childhood stuff, and many other aspects. So before we get into the deeper conversation, I want to ask you, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
And what was your childhood like?
I'm the youngest. I have two older sisters. And we lived in the suburbs and kind of middle class, maybe a little bit higher than that. And yeah, it was a regular suburban upbringing. You know, as I look back on it, it wasn't the happiest childhood in the world. But yeah, there was stability and, you know, everything was that we needed was given. And yeah, I was interested in school. Yeah.
And could you share any memorable favorite story from your childhood?
I think the memory that comes to mind as you ask that question is around that I was brought up Jewish, and we had big family dinners around the Jewish holidays. And I enjoyed my extended family and getting together, and it was always very lively and fun. And those are good memories that I carry with me.
If people do not know about you and your work, how do you usually respond when people ask you, what do you?
Well, first of all, I'm a psychologist, and you know, that's a label, and you know, I have that education. And what I do now, and that work has evolved over many years. I've been practicing as a psychologist over 25 years. And how do I describe my work now is it's about conscious living and living an embodied life that's in presence and openness. And in the living of that, what comes up are the conditioned patterns that most of us carry with us. So it's an integration of present moment awareness and being awake and conscious in our lives and looking at the conditioned patterns that get in the way of that usually come from our childhoods.
Why did you become a clinical psychologist?
You know, I don't have a clear answer to that. After all these years, I still don't know exactly, but I was drawn to it when I was in high school. And, you know, it was from the beginning, I was interested in psychology. I actually started college as a French major, but I went to a place that didn't have a very good French department. So I didn't actually make the right decision there, but I didn't want to transfer to another place. So I ended up becoming a psychology major. And then as soon as that happened, I knew that I was going to go to graduate school. And initially, I didn't want to be a clinical psychologist. I was interested in research, but eventually that shifted. So I'm just interested, curious about the mind, about people, how people work. And yeah, so that's what brought me to psychology.
Were you always curious as a
child? I was rebellious as a child. I, if you would ask my mother, who's now passed, but she would tell me I was a hard kid to bring up, you know, not in the extreme, like I never, you know, was in prison or anything like that. But yeah, I was rebellious. I wouldn't take anybody's word for anything. I had to find out for myself. I, you know, there were some constraints put on me in my family, and that didn't sit well with me. So I was always pushing the limits and not trusting what was being told to me and wanting to figure out for myself what was actually true. And as I look at that now in my path, I think it served me well, that quality, because I've always been curious and I wanted to know for myself. And I was always investigating and asking questions and not taking anything for granted. And yeah, I was like that as a child.
I guess sometimes people, I don't want to generalize this. Maybe sometimes people have trouble believing in themselves, and they might accept everybody's opinion and do not trust their own instincts and opinion. What
that
advice or recommendation to those people?
Yeah, that's a pattern I see a lot in people in my work. So that's skipping to really having compassion for the conditioned patterns that people carry with them. And that's one that brings a lot of pain for people, because if those who don't trust themselves, they're usually looking out to other people, they're trusting what other people tell them about themselves and believe that. And it's, you know, some of the distorted ways that we end up thinking about ourselves comes from believing what other people have told us about ourselves rather than investigating what the truth of that is. So that's a pattern that causes a lot of pain for people.
Then is there any practice or conscious practice to releasing this pattern of not trusting in our own instincts?
I think it's actually a long journey that when we realize that that's the pattern that's living in us, it's like doing one practice and then having it all improve. That doesn't usually happen in my experience, because the pattern was formed way back in childhood, and it's very conditioned in our bodies and in our minds. So it takes a while. Like people who are people pleasers, because they want to make sure that, you know, the outside world approves of them, or you know, for any way in which they don't trust themselves. It takes a while to realize what the problem is and be able to untangle it and bring compassion to ourselves as we work through and recognize that those ideas that we hold about ourselves, those identities that maybe we're not good enough or we're inadequate or worthless or a failure, that we learn that about ourselves, but it's not actually the truth of who we are.
When you work with clients who have gone through different childhood issues and traumas, and I believe it takes work, it takes months and years sometimes, how do you take them from point A to point B in that process?
Well, at this point in time, I do mostly groups. I do see individuals a little bit, but the first quality that's needed, the element of this process, is a relaxed holding. Like people don't know how, usually when they're stuck in their trauma, they don't know how to relate in a healthy way to their own experience. So what I mean by that is a feeling might arise, and, you know, you say, well, I don't like that feeling, so I want to get rid of it. Or people who get stuck in their mind and they're thinking, trying to solve problems by thinking, but missing out on the emotional part of their experience. So, and these are, if this is the case, you know, where people aren't in touch with their feelings so much, that's a useful strategy that develops in childhood, because there isn't the sense of safety and holding and the skills and the care that's needed to be able to be comfortable with our own emotions. So the very first element of the process of healing from that is to find and create a sense of safety. So as a group facilitator or therapist, my first job is to be very relaxed within myself so that I can hold a very safe space for people to do this inner exploration, because it involves going to places that are difficult and tender within us and painful, and the support of a calm and very unconditionally accepting other person is essential for that process. One of the things I sometimes say is that trauma happened in relationship, so it has to heal in relationship. We don't have to do this work by ourselves. In fact, I've gotten to the point now where I feel that we can't do it by ourselves. We need other people. We need to learn how to have healthy relationships as part of the healing from trauma.
Are you saying that a therapist or a psychologist has to ground himself or herself before starting any individual or group session to provide safety to others?
Yeah, that would be a way to say that. Yeah, to ground, to just take a moment, or, you know, I'm sure people do it in different ways. What I do is I just, you know, if I know I'm going to be seeing a client or leading a group, it doesn't take me very long, but I take some time to get quiet and feel grounded inside. And a word I would use is empty. Like, I want to empty myself of anything personal so that I can show up fully for the client or the group that I'm working with. Yeah, so I'm 100% present. Like, I've noticed recently something happens to me when I'm beginning a group or a session with someone. I just noticed there's this like deep relaxation that comes over me. Like, I'm just so present and available and open to whatever arises with this other person. And it just feels very solid and relaxed. And I think that's an important factor that's needed as people, to help people to face their own traumas.
Safety goes in two ways. One way is from the therapist, and second way is from the client itself. So how do you help your patient or client to feel safe if they are having a bad day, or if they are just all over the place in that session?
Yeah. So I teach grounding skills, you know, and there are things that I do in my own life as well. And one is when the primary part has to do with the nervous system. So that's one of the places to focus, not the only place, but one place to focus is to, because when there's stress or a bad day or a strong feeling, there's activation in the nervous system. They always go together, and it may not feel activated always like stressed or anxious. Sometimes the activation is blank or shut down or numb. And that's also a kind of effect of trauma on the nervous system. So one very simple tool is to take a breath. So when you notice that you're activated or stressed or the mind's going, or, you know, we all know what it's like to feel tense in our bodies, is to take a breath. And what I like is put one hand on the heart and one hand on the belly and just take a few slow and conscious breaths. And that's a reset, you know, for many people, not for everyone. For some people, the breath is stressful, so that wouldn't be a good tool for them. But for most of us, it's a calming activity to take a calm and slow and conscious breath and go away from the mind and go away from the outer world and just come back to ourselves, come back home to ourselves to feel more grounded in the present moment.
Then what would be the good tool for those people who have trouble grounding themselves through the breathing technique?
So for some people, breathing is part of their trauma, and so that we don't want to activate that. So another thing would be to touch the fingertips together and just feel that pressure of the fingertips against one another and just kind of focus on that. And another technique would be just pick a sense, like seeing or hearing, and just focus on what sounds are coming in, what you're seeing, just to be very, to use the senses to come into being present in the moment.
In the mindfulness community and in the trauma healing space, everybody talks about breathing, the power of breath. And you are mentioning that breathing can activate trauma. And I'm interested to ask you why breathing can activate trauma.
Yeah, it just depends on what the story of the trauma is. Like if there's something around, like if there's sexual trauma or sexual abuse, and there's might be something around breath that's activating for the person, then the breath wouldn't be a good anchor for them, because it's re-traumatizing to focus too much on the breath. So it depends on the individual situation.
And before we go further, how do you define trauma?
Yeah, you know, it's a word that's used a lot these days. And the focus that I have is on early trauma, which means situations that we were in when we were young. And, you know, these are situations where we're overwhelmed, we're in shock. Sometimes it starts with a sense of being in shock, definitely emotional overwhelm or overwhelm of the nervous system. And we don't have the sense of safety that we need to process what's going on. So we come up with some kind of strategy to support ourselves and protect ourselves, like dissociation, for example, is in some ways a very intelligent strategy when the situation is so stressful that to actually be in it and feel it as it is just too much for the system. So it's when these kinds of events happen, and trauma isn't in the event itself, because people react differently to different events. It's in how we hold it, how we feel about it, how we think about it, how our nervous system reacts. That's where the trauma is. And I've used the word event. And for many of us, especially early on in our lives, it's not just one event that happens. It's a sustained situation that we're in our families, where, you know, from day to day or maybe moment to moment, and it might last for years, we just don't have the sense of safety that we need so that we can trust other people and trust ourselves and trust life. It's just we're always in stress and coping mode. So those are some examples to get a feel of what early trauma is. I can give you a specific example if you'd like.
Please.
I mean, a couple of them. One is, you know, if you have parents who, or one parent or more, who have addictions or are alcoholics, and that, you know, there are traumas around there of not knowing how your father is going to be when you get home from school every day, you know, like, because is he going to be drinking today? Is that going to create, you know, upset and chaos and fighting and maybe violence, create chaotic home life? So, you know, so that's just an example of a chronic type of stress that can be in the home. Another example from an early trauma, like say there's an infant who's hungry, and, you know, like say at three months or 4 or 6 months, we're very dependent. And as humans, we're very dependent on our caregivers for a long period of time. And if that caregiving isn't reliable, there's a sense of stress. So if you can picture, you know, 6 month old standing in the crib, hungry, screaming, because there's a sense of survival, you know, there's the threat of, if I don't eat, I'm actually not going to live. So there's a survival strategy that gets activated there. And then the parent doesn't come for whatever reason, can't, or, you know, there are many reasons why that might happen. The child is left with this tremendous amount of stress in the body, you know, and then if that's a chronic situation, that's very, very difficult on the organism of the child. And, you know, coping with that might be to shut down or to, you know, act out or try to get attention, or, you know, there are different ways people can go with that. But a very stressful, painful way of experiencing childhood.
My today's guest is Amanda Tempest-Jade. I usually record the intro of every podcast guest, but this episode is very unique and different. So if you like this interview, I invite you to check Amanda's work at feralmysticism.com, feralmysticism.com, feralmysticism.com. So again, if you enjoy this podcast, please check out Amanda's work at feralmysticism.com. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nishant. It's really good to be here.
It's really good to be here, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. And when I was reading about you, I literally knew nothing about the terms, techniques, and I am coming to this podcast recording with a very dumb mindset. And I'm curious to learn what is going to come in this conversation. So I think the best place to start with is that, where do you live?
Well, I live in Colorado, out in the Four Corners region on Southern Ute territories. And we, more specifically, if I were to talk about the ecology of where I live in a canyon, and we share the land with juniper trees and pinyon pine and sage that grows here, and fox and mountain lion and owl and hawks and eagles and badgers and all manner of kin and rock. And there's this nice, beautiful, kind of interesting, where we live, this middle ground transitioning place. It's like a transitioning space between, you know, like high mountain forest and desert. So there's a lot of interesting flora and fauna that kind of converge here, which is beautiful to see. So, and be.
When you say we, who are we?
My partner, Matt, and my 5-year-old, Ryan, and our 2 horses, and our many chickens, and our 2 cats, and our dog.
2 horses. So, do you horse ride?
I used to, and I haven't in a couple of years, partly because of my own spaciousness with my life, partly because I've been in this kind of process with my 2 equine kin of wondering what other ways I could actually be in relationship with them that wasn't centered around riding, and partly because the terrain where we are at the moment is tough to, in fact, ride with. We're on a slope, and it's very rocky and treed and all that jazz. So there's a few things in there.
Why do you live in a forest, if I say it correctly, forest?
why do we live in the mountains? Well,
yes,
you know, that's interesting. So the story behind that, when I was still pregnant, Matt was looking to find the tax-free ways to transfer money from a 401k that he had, and he didn't like the companies that it was supporting, and he didn't want to be supporting those companies anymore. And one of the ways to do that is you invest in land. And he, being the engineer and builder that he is, started looking at different places in Colorado and happened upon this patch of about almost 2 acres of land, sight unseen, and just had this intuitive hit and knowing and invested it in the land. And probably within 3 years after that happened, by way of a slew of really intense, rigorous, at times immensely heartbreaking events, we made our way out to this land and started building. So we built about 400 square feet and kind of expanded slowly, gradually over time from there. So that's, and when we came out here before we ever started building, we really sat down with the land here, and there was a real deep bone feeling of being home. And that's saying a lot, because I remember a distinct moment sitting with the land here, and there was a feeling in my body that it reminded me somehow of ancestral and childhood territories of Maine that I grew up with from my mom's side. So my mom is part Passamaquoddy And so those are ancestral territories out there. And there
what is that? What is that word?
The Passamaquoddy. So they're a part of the Wabanaki, and they're First Nations peoples that are out on the east of Turtle Island, United States, Turtle Island. And so there was, so that to me was just this big signal of quote unquote rightness in making our way out here. And it would seem that trickster energies were afoot in the ways that we were kind of slowly ushered in this direction. So
when I was scrolling through your social media post, I read that you call yourself Dragon at heart. Why do you call Dragon at heart yourself?
Oh, that I'm a dragon at heart? Well, for many reasons. Let's see where to begin. So there's maybe more the obvious that I'm kind of fiery and passionate. And I give thanks not only to both of my parents for that, who are a bit of, in their own ways, dragons, but from my dad's side, the Greek and Macedonian and Sicilian ancestry that I have, they're really fiery, passionate, expressive people. So there's that element. And then there's the element of the dragon being one of the oldest symbols of what we in the contemporary West and in other places would point at and call the feminine, that symbol is associated, one of the oldest standing symbols of the quote unquote feminine. And that dragons and serpents, they've been with me since I was little in dreamtime spaces and allurement with imagery. And there's this deep connection with dragons and snakes and serpents ancestrally as well, with mythological figures, which are also ecological forces, in my opinion, such as Medusa, who's got the beautiful, you know, the one that petrifies with her gaze, and the serpent springing from her head rather than hair, a miraculous hybrid. So those are some of the, yeah, that's some of the reasons why I would say that I'm a dragon at heart.
I'm going to be asking a lot of what is type of questions in this conversation.
Sure, go ahead.
So how do you bring your dragon into your work life?
I think it's inherent. I think that the work that I do, if something doesn't bring me alive and I'm not passionate and stirred and lit a fire with interest, then I really won't put any energy into those areas. And this passion for this burning kind of ache to keep following the scent trails of the inexplicable and unexplainable and the mysterious, and the ways that that shows up within the different people that I work with, within the different group settings that I work with, within my day to day, that I am so enamored with the mysterious and the inexplicable and unexplainable, and love to challenge reductionisms.
What is reductionism?
Reductionisms, when we oversimplify, and when culturally, when there's the inclination to oversimplify, I don't want to say we as in royal we, as if I'm speaking for everyone listening in, but when there's the inclination to simplify, or there's the inclination to speak as if things weren't relationally bound to one another, as if you could remove or pluck something from the larger body and understand it. And by that, I would say, you know, it would be as if you're trying to take a cell from the human body and you would pluck it and try and figure out its inner workings, when really the human cell is in relationship to all the other cells in the body. And it's by way of relationship that we really deeply come to understand it, would be one of the ways that I would speak to that.
Before we go further into reductionism and other topics, when someone asks you that, what do you do? How do you usually respond? Because I'm struggling to understand what you do. So how do you respond to people?
I have a variety of responses, and it all depends on how curious someone is and the sincerity of their inquiry. Sometimes it's a question.
Our listeners are curious. Our listeners are very curious.
Yeah.
And Ashnet, please explain.
So yes, so what do I do? Well, one of the shorthand ways that I like to start off is I work with folks in areas of, you might say, human development or personal transformation, and kind of personal transformation that is a widening of the narrative of how someone understands themselves and understands the world and understands their place in the world. And I'm going to go ahead and out myself and say that one of the conversations or the centrails that I've been following recently is really turning over and looking at from different angles what we mean by concepts like purpose and belonging, and to find your purpose and find your way or find your niche. And I think one of the things that I see in that's implied in a lot of those concepts is to suggest that someone hasn't found their quote unquote true purpose yet, and that they need to find their purpose, and there's an ache and a longing. And I might say that I don't know yet that ache or longing ever really in fact goes away. And that there's this way of understanding ourselves as inherently mattering, that to have a purpose is to matter. And what I've been dancing with, both within myself and with others that I work with one-on-one and in groups, is indeed, in fact, understanding that, yes, you are here, you are participatory, that no matter what you're doing, you are participating in the larger storying of the world, the larger shaping of the world. And so in that way, you inherently matter. And you are a mattering force. You are shaping the world. And so then it just begs the question from my end in the work that I do, which is, in what ways do you want to participate? In what ways do you feel called to show up? How are you going to follow what scent trails, tracks, you know, branches broken, rocks turned over, carcasses left behind, scat in the woods? Like, what is it that you're really longing to bring forward at this moment in time from the depths of you, the heights of you, the horizontal stretches of you, and from a place that isn't necessarily inherently a place where we have to struggle to get to? A friend and colleague of mine, she and I were talking about this recently as well, that this notion that actually what's pleasurable, not from a consumerist sense, but what's pleasurable, what really brings us alive and ignites us, that's a part of what we inherently wish to bring into the world, or you could say the world longs to see from us. And so that's a great part of what I'm doing with people is accompanying them, supporting them in that exploration. And that can also then involve other layers that inherently go along with it. And I don't personally find inseparable, which is working with people in trauma and wound alchemy and integration. And I'll just say that I'm not a trauma psychotherapist. It's a bit different nature of the work, but it's also engaging psychospiritual resiliency and resourcing and the ability to widen the narrative, widen the way that we've understood our life thus far, to integrate it in such a way that isn't an attempt to go back to what we were, but is a saying yes to what is so, and because it is so, and all of the different sides and dynamics and complexities to what is so, that we can start to spin more fully towards what is possible. And so that can also involve things like shadow work and dream work and deep imagery work, lots of embodiment, because I'm all about all of this work needing to actually be recognized as coming through the body, as inherently of the body. So I'll stop there.
Are you saying that to live our purpose or to explore our passion, we get to just uncover all these layers and learn different modalities such as shadow work, dream work, and trauma work. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's that all of those modalities support this deepening knowing our own and can support our own personal transformation towards a shape that is currently unknown to us, the shape of what is possible within us, that those modalities do that. They can.
And can we say that personal transformation is the bigger umbrella, and to get to the unknown levels within ourselves, we just get to explore different varieties and modalities that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what I call upon in my work, and that the personal transformation is inherently participatory in the larger evolution of the world. And so it's not, I'm not really hanging with someone, supporting someone, accompanying someone so that they can get a better job or they can get a better relationship, or they'll finally figure out their career. And that might inherently just happen out of my work with someone. But this is actually a little bit different than that. It would be the coming to knowing oneself in the way that mountain lion is mountain lion in the world, and fox is fox in the world, and not every single fox is like every other fox, but there are certainly larger patterns that we can see at play. So it'd be coming to know the deeper shape of who someone is based off of, and who someone is as not being singular, but actually an entanglement of all their relations, human, more than human, unseen, ancestral, place-based. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.